The Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd State Legislative Session will come to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Present.
Vice Chair Fraser?
Present.
Lee Johnson?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Grossel?
Present.
Representative Hollins?
Present.
Representative Hewitt?
Present.
Representative Cleavorn?
Present.
Representative Long? Representative Long?
Just got a message. She's presenting a bill. We should expect them shortly.
Representative Long excused. Representative Lucero?
I just realized I forgot to brew my afternoon caffeine.
Representative Mueller?
Not good. You're
present.
Representative Novotny?
Body present.
Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh present.
Representative Vang?
Present.
Representative Shung?
Present.
And that concludes roll call, Chair. Our quorum is present.
Very well. Quorum is present. Members, this hearing is conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing for hearings to be held via use of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means to protect the health and safety of the public, staff, and members. This hearing is live streamed on the House website and can be accessed via the committee page. Those wishing to offer public testimony can contact via email the committee administrator, Mr. Jamel Lundy, 24 hours prior to a hearing. That address is, that email address is also available on our committee page. So members, let's get in. Want to make sure do we have, let me just ask the clerk, I'm not sure, are the minutes available for today?
Yes, they were sent out this morning.
Very well. So that would be the minutes of March 22nd. Representative, I'm going to pick on somebody else. I always pick on Fraser. He's going to be talking a lot today. Representative Edelson, our former vice chair, would you be so kind as to move the minutes of March 22nd?
I move those minutes, Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you. The motion is before us. Discussion, members. Okay, I'm not seeing any. Representative Johnson, Lee Johnson, a voice vote.
Voice vote would be fine.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The minutes of March 22nd are hereby adopted. Members, today's conversation will be exclusively on House File 4200. We heard this bill under a different iteration at the beginning of session. This is Representative Fraser's public safety innovation bill. Many of you recall that we had fairly robust week, three hearings of discussion on the bill. I'm hoping that we will have a robust sharing and discussion today as well. There have been a number of major changes that Representative Fraser will share to the original concept, and so ergo a new bill number. So with that, let's get the bill in front of us and dig in. Representative Fraser moves that House File 4200 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And Representative Fraser, I believe you have a DE1 amendment.
That is correct, Chair.
All right. Representative Fraser moves the adoption of the DE1 amendment.
Chair Mariani?
Yep.
This is a DE2 amendment.
All right. Let's make sure. Let's get this right. I'm having a staff check right now. Thank you, Lee Johnson. Two. All right. Rep. Fraser, I believe it is the DE2 amendment that you wish to move before us.
That's correct, Chair.
Very well. My apologies. I'm the one who messed that up. Thank you, Lee Johnson. And as long as I have you, this puts the bill in the shape the author has, wants it. A voice vote should suffice?
Voice vote will be fine.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of adopting the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails, and the DE2 amendment is adopted. Representative Frazier, your bill is now in the shape you wish it to be before us. We are in your hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be brief because I know we have a number of testifiers today, and I want to make sure that those individuals taking the time out of their day to be here have an adequate amount of time to be heard. And I also want to allow for adequate time to have a robust discussion around House File 4200. So House File 4200, the Public Safety Innovation Package, it is the package that the framework that I presented in the first week of session. Framework is still the same, but there have been some changes. I will allow House nonpartisan staff to walk through those specific changes after I make these brief comments. But the overall goal and vision of this bill is to make sure that we provide Minnesotans with the resources they need to have and build the public safety framework that they need to make sure that all Minnesotans are safe, regardless of where they live, what they look like, or what their political affiliation is. It is one of our paramount duties as state legislators to make sure that we provide for the safety of our fellow Minnesotans, and that bill does exactly that, providing the resources that are needed to do that for community partnerships, law enforcement, and the organizations that support that work in the local communities. With that, Chair, I will turn it over to nonpartisan staff to walk through the changes that have been made to the bill, and so that members have that understanding. And then I'd like to turn it over to the multitude of testifiers that we have for today.
Wonderful, let's do that. Mr. Johnson and Mr. Debo, you let us know what order you wish to follow here, but we turn to you to explain particularly those new provisions so the members are fully and the public are fully aware. And if you can be as brief as possible, we would certainly appreciate that. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, Ben Johnston from House Research. I'm going to walk through. I'll try to do it quickly as you're requesting. I'm going to walk through each article of the bill so you remember what was in the old bill and understand what's in the new bill at a very high level. Article 1 of House File 2724 created an Office of Public Safety Innovation with a director position, with the responsibility of establishing community grant advisory boards that had the authority to distribute grants in areas with high rates of crime and poverty. It appropriated $40 million for that purpose. It appropriated an unspecified amount for the new office, and it transferred $10 million to the Opiate Epidemic Response Fund for grants issued by the Opiate Epidemic Response Advisory Council. Article 1 of House File 4200 creates a Public Safety Innovation Board of 15 people with the responsibility to administer a variety of grants and also the responsibility to monitor crime trends in the state and provide reports on those grants and trends. It expands the Office of Justice Programs with an appropriation of $4,852,000 on an ongoing basis. It appropriates $55 million in fiscal year 23 and $30 million a year ongoing, adjusted with inflation, for local community innovation grants, which must be given to counties, cities, towns, and tribal governments for any of 10 listed purposes. It appropriates $15 million in fiscal year 23 on a one-time basis for emergency community safety grants administered by the Commissioner of Public Safety. Grants can be awarded to cities, counties, towns, law enforcement agencies, and tribal governments for any of 25 listed purposes. It appropriates $10 million in fiscal year 23 for local co-responder grants that may be awarded to cities, counties, towns, law enforcement agencies, and tribal governments for any of 3 listed purposes. Also appropriates an unspecified amount for the new board, and it appropriates $10 million a year to the Department of Public Safety for grants to organizations as directed by the Opiate Epidemic Response Advisory Council. Article 2 of House File 2724 appropriated $22 million for local community policing grants that had a tails of $5 million a year until fiscal year 27. That grant was to increase patrols outside of a squad car and also increase community partnerships. It appropriated $22 million for crime investigation grants in fiscal year 23. That also had $5 million a year ongoing until fiscal year 27. Those grants were for a variety of purposes related to investigating homicides and non-fatal shootings. It also appropriated $2.5 million in fiscal year 23 for body cameras for local law enforcement agencies, with a requirement that the recipients agree to certain policy requirements. Article 2 of House File 4200 includes a task force on alternative courses to peace officer licensure. This is in Article 3 of House File 2724. It appropriates just over $6 million a year to the Department of Public Safety for body camera storage, and also appropriates $9 million in fiscal year 23 for body cameras for local law enforcement agencies, again, with requirements that the recipients agree to certain policy requirements. It appropriates $15 million a year in fiscal year 23, and then $10 million a year in fiscal years 24 and 25, adjusted for inflation, for local community policing grants. Those go to counties, cities, towns, and tribal governments with a law enforcement agency for any of six identified purposes related to attracting and retaining peace officers or connecting officers with the community. And it appropriates $15 million in fiscal year 23, again with $10 million in fiscal year 24 and 25, adjusted for inflation. That is for local investigation grants. Those also go to counties, cities, towns, and tribal governments with the law enforcement agency. And those can be for any of 11 identified purposes. Back to House File 2724, Article 3 of that bill established that a peace officer does not need to be convicted of a crime in order for the Post Board to take licensing action. It amended the requirements related to written policies for body camera footage. It authorized local governments to give more authority to civilian oversight councils and made changes to the information those councils could consider. And it established the task force on alternative courses to peace officer licensure that we've already discussed. It also repealed some sections of Chapter 214 related to the Post Board's authority to take licensing action. Article 3 of House File 4200 amends a portion of Chapter 214, which permits the Post Board's director to order a local law enforcement agency to investigate an alleged violation by a licensed peace officer. It requires the Post Board to adopt rules authorizing licensing action in cases where a peace officer has not been convicted of a crime. It amends the requirements related to written policies for body camera footage in a way that's very similar to the changes that were in House File 2724. It authorizes local governments to give more authority to civilian oversight councils. This language is identical to what was in House File 2724. It amends the session law that passed last June to clarify that the $6 million Philando Castile Memorial Training Fund can only be used for training costs related to crisis response, conflict management, and cultural diversity, or for autism training. It appropriates $2.5 million in fiscal year 23 to the Commissioner of the Office of Higher Education to provide reimbursement grants to post-secondary schools that are certified to provide programs of peace officer education related to in-service training programs in the use of force, including deadly force, duty to intercede, and conflict de-escalation. And finally, Mr. Chair, it appropriates $2.5 million to the Post Board to hire investigators and other staff to conduct compliance reviews, investigate alleged code of conduct violations, and obtain or improve equipment for those purposes. Mr. Chair, that's the end of the walkthrough comparing the articles of the two bills, again, at a very high level.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate that. Very efficiently done. Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, I'll now turn it over to the listed testifiers for today.
Very well. I do have a good, healthy list here. We'll begin with Superintendent Drew Evans of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Welcome to the committee, Superintendent.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. Thank you for having me here today. I am here on behalf of Commissioner Harrington, who sends his regrets, who wanted to testify today but was otherwise tied up. What I was asked to testify about in relation to this bill is that it's very important from our perspective, and you heard the commissioner talk about this as he was presenting the agency budget bill, that there's really a holistic approach to community safety. And part of that and some of the pieces that are addressed in this bill are those community supports that from our perspective, as we've developed our approach within the Department of Public Safety in examining this, is looking at that prevention, intervention, enforcement as a holistic approach to community safety. And this bill has many important components that would address that and providing those proper community supports that are outside the law enforcement realm in terms of providing different programming that are different ways to examine and prevent violence from occurring in many of our communities. In addition, the body camera program and the grants, we know, and Commissioner Harrington has noted this, that there is importance to be able to fund that for our communities across Minnesota. Many of our law enforcement agencies would like to have body cameras and participate, but are often cost prohibitive. And so rolling out those grants is really important to them in that work. And then lastly, from our perspective, in addition to that, there's some important components as well that I'm sure you've heard in your conversations with Commissioner Harrington over the years, that community policing is a really important component of effective policing within our communities, and that community policing where we work in conjunction and partnership with our community partners to solve problems and really be engaged with the community is a really important component. And those grants will certainly allow our agencies to develop and dedicate the time to be able to do that during times where there are shortages and difficulties, and making sure that they can address those partnerships that are really important to solving problems in conjunction with the community. So I know you have a lot of testifiers, so I'll go with that. But again, that important component of prevention, intervention, and enforcement, that holistic approach to community safety is really important from the commissioner's perspective and mine as well.
Very well. Thank you, Superintendent Evans, for your comments and thoughts, as well as sharing on behalf of the commissioner, particularly the affirmation of those three critical elements to this bill. Next, we have Kate Weeks from the Office of Justice Programs at the Department of Public Safety. Welcome, Director Weeks.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs with the Department of Public Safety. I wanted to say thank you for giving me a moment to come and speak to this bill. As you can see, this bill makes significant investments, not only in community partners throughout Minnesota, but also into law enforcement and local units of government, which allows communities to best decide how they need to address situations of violence, violence intervention, and violence prevention. It creates an opportunity for communities to come together and best decide how they would like to address these issues. And it also provides a wide variety of ways to do that. It is not a specific grant program. It provides lots of ability for communities to decide which levers, which resources, which initiatives that they need to make those changes for themselves. And I also wanted to say thank you for the investment in OJP to not only implement these changes and these programs, but also to have staff available to travel throughout the state to talk about the resources available that OJP has, to talk about how to apply for a grant, to build capacity in communities, to not only access these resources, but also use these resources to the best of their abilities and to make sure that money is directed into those communities where it's going to make the most difference. And I also wanted to say thank you to Representative Frazier for working with me and my staff as we figure out how best to implement this and implement your vision. I appreciate that. And thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Director Weeks. And next we have Commissioner Jeff Lundy, Hennepin County Commissioner. Welcome back to our committee. Commissioner, please state your name for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Chairman Mariani and members, my name is Jeffrey Lundy. I'm a Hennepin County Commissioner. On the board, one of my responsibilities is to chair the Public Safety Committee. I will do my best to be brief. My level of excitement often betrays my inability to control my verbosity, so I'll do my best to move quickly.
We certainly do want to hear your best. So
yes, I will. I'll plow through.
Don't cut out things that are important to say.
No. So I just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify again before your committee today. about the need for the integrated approach of public safety and behavioral health, working together to support our residents facing mental health challenges. This is an important step to improve the response that we give to people in crisis. Along with these investments in behavioral response, Hennepin County is also invested in community partners for providing violence prevention efforts in partnership with police departments. The collaboration between public safety and behavioral health builds capacity with the emergency response systems to better manage mental health calls. As we all know, right now we're having a challenge making sure that our police departments are fully staffed, that every call has been responded to. So we know that if we can offload some of those mental health calls to mental health professionals, therefore giving the best possible service to the what is needed, we can actually make this system more efficient and really try to focus our officers on the things that they need to focus on, allowing public health to be handled by mental health professionals. You know, oftentimes on Twitter and in the media, people are acting like there's this big fight where there's this huge disagreement between, you know, what public safety is, what it should be. I'm here to tell you that every day, public safety, police chiefs, fire chiefs, community members, church leaders, all kinds of people of different communities are working together to give the best possible public safety system that we can. And this is nothing transformation, nothing, you know, it's nothing that is not needed. It's not wanted. Everybody wants to bring this forward, and we're all trying to work together to get this done. An example I would give is just, you know, as mayor of Brooklyn Park, we used to have a fire department that just responded to fire calls. We had paid on call, duty crews. People would, you know, respond, and it has evolved over time. Now, Brooklyn Park Fire Department, along with many fire departments, offer EMS services. They have full-time firefighters. Many of these firefighters have EMT certifications. Some have paramedic skills. I mention that because I want to remove the idea that people are not engaged in this. People are very engaged with delivering different types of services. And these are good examples. This is the evolution of public safety. We're at the forefront today to talk about that. Another one of the county programs is our embedded social workers, which is one of our delivery methods that we deliver non-police response to calls. From the onset, the program's goals have been to provide intervention and stabilize services to residents in need. It does this in three main ways. It applies mental health expertise and resources to emergency calls. It improves outcomes for people in crisis and responding professionals. It also allocates emergency response resources in the most effective and efficient manner. Currently in Hennepin County, 23 police departments are in partnership with the county for this embedded social worker program. All the social workers are run through the police department. They are focused on providing mental health and services to residents in need. And it's a partnership between behavioral health and police, and it's happening right now, happening every day. Just last year, we actually increased the number of cities by 7, and you are starting to see, I would expect, that this number will spread throughout all the cities in Hennepin County. We are getting ready later this summer, early fall, to offer a 911 mental health dispatch. We will be running a pilot in partnership, most likely with Brooklyn Park Police Department. And the idea is that we can deliver mental health response using the 911 dispatch. Currently, 911 uses, you've got police, you've got fire, you've got ambulance. What we're gonna say is we're gonna offer a fourth level of service. And that way people get the kind of service that they need that people don't fear. Some people have a fear of calling 911 because they know maybe a loved one is having a mental health episode and they want a person who's trained in that, and we're gonna be able to deliver that soon. Lastly, I wanted just to highlight our community partnership for violence prevention diversion. 2021, the county invested money directly into community groups to provide alternate response to community needs for public safety. All of these investments and community partners were done in full partnership with cities, police departments, and the community at large. So it wasn't like RFPs were put out there and anybody got to apply. We actually partnered. We talked with police departments. We made sure that the people we were partnering with that were actually doing the work. We also made sure that they were partnering outside of our contract, that there had to be a back and forth. An example I want to give you, I know people ask, well, prove it works. You know, you say this stuff and, you know, is it just throwing money out there? So Minnesota Acts Now is the organization that we used in Brooklyn Park. They were a county partner and a city partner, and they worked at three different locations to augment services to lessen violence. At one location, there was a 20% reduction in calls to service within 1 month. In the other location, there was a 50% reduction in calls for service within 2 months. We know that this works. I have actually done walk-alongs with the violence prevention teams to see what they do. I would encourage anybody on this committee who would like to actually see what this is, remove the mystery, to take that up and reach out. People would love to take you out and show you what they are doing. Examples of further success is the city of Brooklyn Park has entered into their own contract to continue these services. And the county has recently continued our investment from 2021 and 2022 to make sure that we are trying to divert and do the best that we can to lessen violence and hopefully head it off before it happens. And lastly, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. We are completely at that moment in time where we can evolve the public safety system. How do we respond? What we respond with? And it's with our partnership between cities, county, and the state that we can get this done. So thank you.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. And I certainly concur. This is a good moment in time. It's good that you were able to walk through examples of how your communities and in your county are acting, moving. And I think what we're all looking for here, I believe from all, you know, all political communities is good, effective ways in which we can, we meaning the state, can partner and help resource and walk along with our locals. So it's good to have good public servants like you thinking very solidly about that. Very well. Next, we have Tracy Hines, I believe is how you pronounce it. Correct me if I'm wrong, from the Central Minnesota Mental Health Center. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. It's Tracy Hines. You're close.
I was close.
You were. Thank you so much for having me. This bill is super exciting, and I find it a pleasure and a privilege to be able to kind of share some testimony with you. I am with Central Minnesota Mental Health Center. I'm an LICSW, have been with the Mental Health Center for about 15 years. Central Minnesota Mental Health Center serves what could be considered rural Minnesota, Wright, Sherburn, Stearns, and Benton. And I want to come and provide a framework for some of our current work that we're doing that is really gaining traction and much momentum in terms of our mobile crisis team, which has been in existence for a number of years, of which we have figured out how to build partnerships, active partnerships with our law enforcement in all four counties. And of recent, we have a co-responder team, primarily with Stearns, and then we've also embedded co-responders with Sherburn, and it won't be long before Wright and Benton are to follow. So some really cool things happening out here in rural Minnesota that I have the privilege of seeing firsthand. I don't do the actual interventions. I'm the mental health professional that's on call, primarily in the evenings and the weekends. So I'm on the end where we get calls and the practitioner calls me, tells me the scenario. I approve the mobile and I kind of am the decision maker about whether or not we involve the law enforcement or not. And if we do, how we actively partner during the interventions with families, children, adults, whatever. And then if I need a law enforcement person to be on site to ensure safety, then how do I help the practitioner who's alongside them manage the situation and feel comfortable saying to the law enforcement person, we're good, go, like, I got this. So it's a really cool handoff that occurs. And rural Minnesota, you know, we have our unique challenges. Every setting, I think, has challenges, but some of the things that I think can really be adequately addressed through this bill are our travel time. I'll give you an example. Just on Monday, I had a mobile which occurred and we needed a law enforcement officer. And the mobile was in Delano and my practitioner that was going to be coming down was in Avon. And it was a matter of coordinating travel time between and the immediacy of what was necessary in the moment for safety with with the Wright County Sheriff and then the practitioner not being able to get down for, you know, roughly 45, 50 minutes or so. So there's some travel time that's unique to rural Minnesota. Lack of resources, We've had co-responder openings in both of our areas right now for months with few applicants. So there's the workforce issue, I think, that also this bill can help address. And I really think, you know, that I appreciated the testimony before me, because the mental health component of this and how together, collectively, law enforcement can come together with behavioral health and start to really thread together the early interventions, the proactive reach outs, the immediate solutions to divert hospitalizations, crime, arrest, and then ultimately get folks the help they need. Like, we, the immediate safety and crisis intervention is provided, but then we all know that there's more steps to helping people maintain their wellness or get the immediate help that they need. And that's where the mental health professionals and the mental health system really come in handy. And then also just continued partnership on frequent calls, frequent folks, especially in the rural area, that are well known and continually are interacting with the law enforcement. Once the mental health professionals or the mental health system can get involved, I think the calls lessen, because the mental health issues are taken care of, and there's such a strong thread between mental health issues and law enforcement calls that collectively tackling them together, I think, is quite helpful. So I could go on and on. I've had the pleasure of seeing firsthand how well this framework works and the meaningful interactions that are done. And I can name stories, I can remember specifics where my practitioners have said, wow, that officer really helped me. And officers have come back and said, this was a really cool interaction. We worked well together and we were very effective. So I think this bill is fantastic and so much appreciate the time being given.
Yeah, I muted. Absolutely. Thank you for your time here today, and particularly sharing, you know, on the ground experiences, particularly from greater rural Minnesota. I think it's a constant good reminder for us all as state legislators of a very big state with incredible geographic diversity in the state. You know, we've got communities everywhere in the state, you know, where obviously our indigenous communities go back hundreds of years, and our European-based communities go back many, many generations. And so that creates, in my mind, all sorts of very unique ways to do things. And so to be able to hopefully be crafting, legislation that is malleable and flexible for people like you in your particular part of the state to adapt and shape and be effective. It seems to me that's our best calling as legislators. I also do think I keep hearing this story over and over again about how addressing, the mental health, response issue has all sorts of benefits, including, lessening the calls to law enforcement and being able to focus those energies much more efficiently and effectively. It sounds like that's what's happening up in your area. So thank you for sharing that, Director Hinz. Next, we have Mickey Lewis of the Truth Center. Executive Director, if you can come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony, we would greatly appreciate it.
Hey, how's everybody doing it? Yeah, my name is Makai Lewis Frost. It's okay. I haven't met anybody yet that, it's either Mickey or Makai. So to everybody out there, either one is perfectly fine with me. I don't find offense to it. So, just don't call me anything other than that. Then,
there you go.
Everything will be fine. Okay, so I'm the founder of the 8-18, the Truth Centers. What are they, if you haven't heard? They're safe spaces where kids can come they can hang out, they can be mentored with everything from community awareness, conflict resolution, depression, and suicide prevention. I often say it's some of the stuff that some of us had to learn the hard way, bumping our heads when we were kids, that, you know, we try to teach these kids now, you know, so that they don't bump their heads as hard as some of us had to. The second dynamic is what we do is truce-ing. So if you're being bullied at school, if you know some people that are having a conflict, or if you're having a conflict, you know, what we do is using our resources either through Facebook or social media or through our connections with law enforcement, we find out those individuals that are out here shooting and fighting and doing these things to each other. And we reach out to them and see if we can get them to come and sit down and work them that out before it ends up escalating to something that's just becoming, it seems like, a norm in our communities. It's just how the violence is just, you know, out of hand. And, you know, being in this community all my life, I know firsthand experience on how important it is to be able to have a mediator when there's some conflict that's going on. Somebody that can come in and help two individuals stop going through what they're going through, and we don't have that. So my organization offers the chance for, you know, these kids that feel they have no way out of once they get into a situation. We give them that way out. So that, with partnering up with the schools, is to be able to have these small centers in all the problem communities across the state, just not here in St. Paul or Minneapolis, but up in the rural parts of Minnesota where there's violence and these kids are struggling. We need to be able to have conflict centers up there where these kids can be able to come, meet new friends, and also be able to dissolve some of those issues that they're having there with the school systems. How about while these kids are going to school and you hear about a situation that may take place after school, being somebody right there that can take and get those kids out of those classes right then and there and let them work it out before school ends, so that our schools does not turn into, you know, just these hot pots of violence. I think it's more critical that this bill is finally, you know, recognized so that the funding can come to these boots on the ground organizations that are really doing the work that, you know, often get overlooked by other organizations that are bigger and have a better, you know, maybe track record or history, but aren't doing the work that some of these boots on the ground organizations are capable of doing. We often say that, you know, taxpayers' money, or it's the money and that's the problem or whatnot. Well, this is maybe a chance to say, if it is the taxpayers' money or whoever money, if it's this side's money or that side's money and everybody wants to complain about where the money should go, well, I just ask, why not say, let's take the money and help where it needs to be helped? If it's your money, can this be a time that you say, fine, here's some of my money to help stop a problem that's, you know, affecting every one of us? This isn't an issue that is just taking place in these, you know, urban communities. If we start to look, more than ever, they're starting to venture out. So if we don't fix a problem in one area, where do you think that problem is going to go? It's going to find its way right into your community. So instead of feeling like that's just a problem for one, you know, set of people or one community, we have to start to understand that we need to try new innovative, you know, techniques that we have maybe never tried before. Start involving some of these community people into some of these areas that can help. The way you fix a community is not bringing outsiders into a community to fix something that they aren't very familiar with. You have to take that very community and start to work with that community and let that community fix itself. That's just the way that it needs to happen. If we have not never tried that, I think it's time for us to try that as a whole. And I just thank you for the opportunity to come here. And Fraser, you know, thank you so much for giving us just this chance to even just be heard. But I just encourage every single one of us to, you know, stop pointing the finger this way and start turning those fingers back around and start saying, well, what can I do? What can I help to change? You know, if I don't help this way or I've never helped that way, why not this be the year that I say, you know, fine, let me try to help some people that are in need. And this is what it's all about, finally coming together and realizing that we are one people. you know, that divide is, to me, it seems as if that divide is getting more bigger with every day that passes, because we don't want to continue to, you know, deal with these issues that's plaguing us all. And just before I go, I'll just say, to me, if the stories that take place in some of these communities, and we talk about gun violence and the kids and the dying, it's kind of like being, you know, out in the camp, and you're all sitting around and you're listening to those scary stories while you sit around the campfire. Well, it almost seems as if the only people that are scared at the end of those scary stories being told are the people that have to go into a cabin that's right around that campfire. The people that can get in their cars and drive away from that cabin, to them, it was just a scary story. But to all of us, it was the truth. It's real. It's what has happened and what is happening in our communities. And it's time to stop having these scary stories that, you know, we only feel is affecting, you know, the ones that are sitting around at the camp. It's affecting us all, even back down in the cities once you get away from that campsite. So thank you so much for having me. I look forward to, you know, more conversation. And, hey, I'm here.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Lewis. And thank you for your work in my city of St. Paul. Appreciate the practical wisdom that you've shared, particularly this call for self-help and for good resources for that. Thank you so much. All right, next we have Joel Franklin, Director of Community Ambassadors Initiative. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony. We're a little behind time, folks. I want to make sure that, you know, committee members also have an opportunity to weigh in. So let's keep that in mind as we go forward. Welcome, Mr. Franklin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and members. Thank you for having me. My name is Joel Franklin, Executive Director of Community Ambassadors Initiative. I just want to start off. I just remember about 10 years ago, I was at a community meeting at Mount Olivet Baptist Church in St. Paul. And it was regarding community violence. And I never forget, this mom stood up and just said she was really frustrated. The meeting was held by Ramsey County. And she was like, "Our babies are dying in the streets. And what are you going to do?" And that stuck with me. And about 9 years ago, the Community Ambassadors Initiative started. We started in partnership with the St. Paul Mayor's Office and St. Paul Police Department to have youth workers out in the community, engaging young people, intervening in issues. We initially started as a pilot program downtown St. Paul. Based on that success, we went citywide. We have what we call now ambassadors. They're community youth workers. All of them are part-time, independent contractors. So they work their day jobs. Most of them work in the schools. They work in the rec centers. They work in juvenile corrections. So they all experienced youth workers that have experience with youth already. St. Paul is St. Small, so a lot of them, they know the youth and they know the families. So that's one way they're able to have such success intervening with fights and other issues. Once we started, like I said, downtown, pilot downtown, we went citywide. After that first year, we went citywide. During the time that the ambassador was working, there was actually a 63% reduction in juvenile arrests when they were working. Basically, the ambassadors are engaging young people. We de-escalate fights. Actually, on a daily basis, we're running into youth that have guns. And we've been very successful in convincing young people either to go home, to walk away. We even, based on the trust, we were able to have a few young people give us the guns and we turned them over to the police. Recently, there were several cases where my staff came upon a group of young people where literally one young man was pointing a gun at the chest of another young man. And based on the relationship that they already had with that young man with the gun, they were able to convince him to put the gun down and leave. And that's been happening on a regular basis. The ambassadors, basically what we do, we build relationships, we do mentoring on the streets, we refer to other resources, and then we work closely with the City of St. Paul's Right Track program. We provide work readiness training, and then we are able to provide the young people with jobs. We've been highly successful in that. In 2019, based on the increased gun violence, Mayor Carter invited us to be part of the Community First Public Safety Initiative. Due to that initiative, we actually were able to grow. So we went from having 30 ambassadors out in the street engaging young people to over 50. We were averaging about 3,000 contacts with young people a year, but after we were able to grow the number of ambassadors and we were able to double the number of teams that we had on the street, we increased our number of engagements from 3,000 to over 30,000. And I think partly that was due because the city also gave us some support on how we track our data. So actually the ambassadors have an app on their phone that they can enter the data. So I think we're collecting better data. I guess one of the main things I wanted to talk on for this bill is, I've been doing youth work and nonprofit work for about 14 years. When we first started the ambassadors, most of our money came from corporations and foundations. And, you know, most grants from foundations, you know, they last 3 years and then they move to the next big thing. As you all know, this is not a three-year problem. So this is a generational problem. So we're really going to need some stable, you know, permanent funding. And when I talked to the funders initially, they all said, well, the city is benefiting the most. The county is benefiting the most. You should get money from the city and the county. And we've been fortunate to partner with the city. Like I said, we got funds from the city's Community First Public Safety Initiative from Mayor Carter. We've had contracts with Ramsey County. We had contracts from Metro Transit Police when Chief Harrington was the police chief, now it's Commissioner Harrington. And we still have a contract with Metro Transit Police. So we've been fortunate to keep going based on our funding from government entities. But I've been asked the last few weeks, actually, from organizations that want to help us, you know, what's your greatest need? And the greatest need is resources, funding. So I like the idea that this bill is going to try to establish some permanent funding. I know we get our funds from the city of St. Paul, and I know they could greatly use those funds to help us to expand. So with that, I'll stop there.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Franklin. And a lot of wisdom there. Not a three-year issue, a general issue, therefore requiring an approach of permanency in terms of long-term resources. Well said. Thank you. Thank you for the work that you do. Greatly appreciate it. All right, next we have Justin Terrell, the Minnesota Justice Research Center. Come forward, please, Director Terrell. Good to see you. You might be muted.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani. Thank you for having me. I'll make my comments quick and brief. First of all, I just want to commend the committee for continuing to take this this bill seriously and continuing to expand the conversation around it. There's three things I want to say to you all today. That the need for permanent funding and for innovative community grants is so desperately needed. We need to stop pretending that the uptick in violence is something that we're surprised by, and just make sure that we take an innovative approach to responding to it. We've never funded the community side of community safety, and which leads to my second point, that we need to improve, we need law enforcement to be able to improve the relationships in the community so that they can do what they only law enforcement can do. So we're talking about investigations and whatnot and gathering intelligence. You can't do that without having a strong relationship in the community. When I think about what happened in my neighborhood when Jamiri Rice was murdered in front of his school back in February, law enforcement was able to catch the suspects in 4 hours. And they didn't do that by themselves. They did that because community members were able to tell them what happened and was able to work with them. And so we need to fund efforts that support those kinds of strategies and collaboration so that people feel confidence in law enforcement. And then finally, I want to be real. I'm kind of the hawk on this one, Chair Mariani, Representative Frazier. I will just say that we need to evaluate all of our public safety approaches. Too often we are cutting checks to law enforcement, we're cutting checks to organizations in the community, and we're not learning from what they're doing. What's the secret sauce that a Makai Lewis might have, right? Like what is happening in these communities? How are we learning from the networks and relationships that are available to prevent violent crime? We just continue to, I think part of it is the politics around violent crime. And I think it's really important that if we're taking innovative approaches to solving these problems, that we evaluate and we learn from them. There's a history around research and evaluation that's not pretty, and I get that. But I believe that this committee and the right community partners at the table can help us learn from law enforcement efforts and community efforts to disrupt what's happening in the community right now across the state. And so I will just conclude my comments and say that, and just remind this committee that in February, I attended 3 funerals for 3 Black men in 3 weeks. And all of those funerals were preventable. And that if we take innovative, if we take approaches like what's suggested in this, if we take approaches like what's in this bill, we can prevent more sad situations like that. And I also just want to clarify, I know that there is evaluation in the bill. We've provided input on that from the Minnesota Justice Research Center. But I just really want to encourage you all to prioritize that as a key component to this structure. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your hard work. And I appreciate all the community members on the call and the voices of law enforcement who seek to serve our communities every day. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Terrell. Thank you for the call for moral action, but also thank you for the call for good evaluation action so that we can learn and grow as a people. I think that is a distinguishing feature in Representative Frazier's bill. Members, we have public testifiers who have signed up to testify, Representative Frazier. So we're going to move to them. First, we have, I'm going to mix up this last name. I apologize. Molly Lutz of Moms Demand Action. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony.
Thank you. It's okay. Lutz is a comment. It's Lloyds.
That sounds nicer. Yeah.
It does, right? I know. Thank you, Chairman Mariani and members of the committee, and to the people who testified. It's been really powerful, and your perspectives are really appreciated. So I'm Molly Lloyds. I'm the state chapter lead for the Minnesota chapter of Moms Demand Action for Common Sense in America. Moms Demand Action is a grassroots movement of Americans fighting for public safety measures that can protect people from gun violence. I am born and raised in Minneapolis, lived out of state for a little bit, and chose to come back here and raise our kids here in Minneapolis. I've got 2 Minneapolis public school kids who are not currently school kids. It's another issue. But so the city and what goes on here and in this state is really important to me. So I thank you for this opportunity to speak in favor of House File 4200, and thank you, Rep. Frazier, for bringing this important bill to reimagine public safety in Minnesota by funding community violence intervention work. HF 4200 establishes a local community innovation grants program, which would support local violence intervention efforts that are data-informed and community-centered. These community violence prevention programs are at a unique intersection of community and city-led public safety and can effectively engage people driving the majority of our gun violence in Minnesota. It's critical that these funds reach the community partners and credible messengers like Mackay and like the community ambassadors we heard from today, who are most prepared to implement a community-based violence interruption strategy that works. Counties, cities, towns, and federally recognized Indian tribes should use these funds to partner with and support the community-based organizations and violence interrupters poised to expand this work within their own neighborhoods. Gun violence, as we've all said, it continues to be a problem. It's a growing problem in our communities. And the past 2 years have been especially challenging in cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul, and expanding outside of the metro for sure. Thankfully, we have a growing body of evidence as to what municipalities, community organizations, and leaders can do to prevent the daily acts of community gun violence that are disproportionately impacting communities of color in our cities. Gun violence prevention and intervention programs have demonstrated that violence can be reduced when we identify and target prevention and intervention strategies in the small segment of population who are at the highest risk of being involved in gun violence. So it's critical now more than ever that we provide sustained support. And so I echo that call for sustained funding and support to these programs. And I urge your support on this really important bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lloyds, for your testimony, but more importantly, for the work that you do in our state in Minnesota. Next, we have Eileen Collard. Again, my apologies if I got that wrong, a volunteer with Moms Demand Action. Ms. Collard.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Mariani and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Collard, as in Greens. I've been a Minnesota resident since 1971, and I'm now a volunteer with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Thank you for this opportunity to express my strong support for House File 4200 that will innovate public safety solutions in our state. In my role welcoming new Moms Demand members, I get to talk with people from all over the state. When I ask new members why they decided to step up now, I hear things like, my oldest will be starting preschool next year and I dread her having to go through lockdown drills. Or, it's time to stand up to what's going on. Enough is enough. We don't have to live this way. Or, my son was killed last month and I have to speak out somehow. Or, why don't they do something so that we can feel safe? They is you guys in part, and us, all of us. Representative Fraser's bill offers a detailed statewide plan to encourage innovation in public health, public safety approaches. The plan includes community voices, along with the voices of law enforcement and mental health professionals, and sets out concrete steps to strengthen partnerships, improve practices for hiring and disciplining police officers, and incorporate community-based violence prevention strategies that do reduce gun violence. Voices of the community, the people who see and live with the effects of gun violence every day and other kinds of violence as well, are coming up with effective solutions, and they should be centered in this conversation, as I think a lot of us here agree. This bill acknowledges their efforts and recognizes the need for ongoing support to continue and expand them. The bill not only provides for local community and innovation grants, it also allows funding to be used for technical support to train community leaders already committed to these efforts and increase their capacity to implement community-centered public safety. It gives more than lip service to involving mental health workers in 911 responses, as you've heard testified today as well. By funding this public health approach to gun violence, the state will be able to focus on our hardest hit neighborhoods across the state and enable municipalities who are disproportionately affected by gun violence to make our communities safer. Evidence indicates that community-focused public health approaches can indeed reduce all kinds of violence, including gun violence. Community partners have local expertise and have been doing this work for years with little support. Local gun violence intervention groups, such as Mad Dads and A Mother's Love, in addition to those that have been mentioned here today, have been on the front lines before and during the challenges of the pandemic. As lawmakers tasked with ensuring public safety in our state, I urge you to advance this exciting and much needed bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Collard. Appreciate the focus on community-centered approaches, particularly with public health approaches. And it is interesting to me, you know, that what often is talked about as opposites and exclusive of one another, you see as being reinforcing and needed, you know, so community voices and law enforcement, recruiting and accountability. I think there's a lot of wisdom in that observation. Thank you so much. Next, we have Frank McCrary from SEIU. Mr. McCrary, welcome to the committee. And you might be muted.
All right, hello, can you hear me?
All right, I can hear you.
All right, well, good afternoon, everybody. I want to thank Representative Fraser for this opportunity to speak. I'm going to speak a little bit about the CSS program. The CSS program is Community Safety Specialist. This is something that came about with the help of SEIU Local 26, Community Org called NERC, and Next Level Security. What the CSS model is we are just uploading something that's been done for 30 years organically. The pilot is focused on Northside Minneapolis. What we're doing is we're just uplifting what's already been in place. Kind of echoing the words of Brother Mackay when he had said, the individuals that are here in our community are the ones responsible for making our community safe. and also reimagining what community safety actually looks like, and getting to the people what they actually want to see and how they want to feel and how we should go about it. The great thing about the Community Safety Specialist Program is that we are the first and only program in the country that has community safety as an actual grade. So we have what's called the gold standard through the Minnesota Department of Labor that has the Community Safety Specialist Program act just like an apprenticeship with an electrician or a carpenter. That way, we're able to bring in the sustainability that we're speaking about. The union's role is leveling up and bringing that level of community safety to a much higher level, raising the playing field and for what we want to see safety in our community. The great thing about it through the Community Safety Program is that the apprenticeship, usually for an apprenticeship for an electrician or a carpenter, is 144 hours. We have over 220 hours. That focuses on mental health, the focus is on de-escalation, the focus is on addiction. A lot of these things in place that we see in the community on a regular basis, but just can't plug the resources from one side to another. This way we're able to do that. Also in turn is providing jobs and careers for the young and old all throughout our community. Our current pilot program that is live, up in action, now running, our youngest apprentice is, we have a 24-year-old, our oldest is 61. So from our elders to our babies, we're involving anybody from our community to come and do this. Getting folks the right training, getting folks the actual sensibility of knowing who and where they are, and focusing on the relationships in the community is one of our main things. We know everybody over here. We're born and raised Northsiders. I'm still over in North Southern Minneapolis. I'm not going anywhere. Proud owner, put that in there, as well as making the steps that we can all come together and make it happen. Another great thing about the Community Safety Specialist Program is that, here's a good word, insurance. All of our people that we have out there in the streets are insured. Another great thing that the SEIU has brought to the table, all the full benefits, sick, vacation, training, during the training time, you're getting paid for training, is $19.50 an hour. When you get to your journey person, you'll be at $23 an hour, which is going to actually help us a lot in terms of how this bill will actually keep the people in the place to actually involve in the community who are invested, who are from there, to give them a livable wage to do that with benefits. Combine that with the amount of training to raise the bar of community safety and also have a work as a trade. This is something live action right now that is happening in our state of Minnesota, Northside, Minneapolis, that is changing the game. And a bill like this would definitely help in making those funds sustainable for us to move forward. There ain't nothing like having Lil Poogie and Mr. Johnson get together and work on a team. It's beautiful. It's organic, and it's been happening, and we just want to keep it going. So from there, I'll go ahead and pass it on. Thank you.
All right. Very well. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. McCrary. And a good reminder that public safety takes everyone in our community, including our labor brothers and sisters. So thank you for your work. We have two more testifiers. I'd like to get through as quickly as I can. So if you can keep your comments precise, that would be really helpful so that we give an opportunity for the committee members also to weigh in. So next we have Ms. Raisha Williams of Guns Down, Love Up. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Representative Frazier, and thank you, Chairman Moraney. This is Raisha Williams. I'm from Guns Down, Love Up, a nonprofit here in the Twin Cities that focuses on gun violence prevention. We've worked with a lot of the groups here on the call, so I'm really excited to see everybody here. I want to take the time to just tell you about Guns Down, Love Up briefly and then share why we believe in this bill and want to support it. Guns Down, Love Up started in 2018 after my brother, Tyrone Williams, was murdered in front of my mother's home. I was the last person to see him take his last few breaths of life before he transitioned on. After that really tumultuous experience, we as a family funded and started Guns Down, Love Up to promote gun violence prevention in the African-American community and communities of color with a focused interest in African-Americans and Native Americans. Gun violence has been a strong a strong piece of our community for the last 4 or 5 years, and it's just growing. As we know, African Americans are 10 times more likely than white Americans to die from gun violence, and African Americans are 14 times more likely than white Americans to be wounded by gun violence. And so one of our community commitments is to focus on prevention, intervention, and restorative justice. Our programs at Guns Down Love Up focuses on working with the community to do prevention in an at-large capacity. So we've launched a couple of campaign PSA media campaigns that promotes the entire community to put love and conflict resolution over gun violence. A lot of times in our community, we have retaliation that's taking place, and that is a lot of the upsurge that you're seeing in the north side, where one community member is murdered by another and the family or friends or associates retaliate. And so we want to do, we want to work on talking about conflict resolution and how do we resolve from that conflict and working it out so that it doesn't continue on. The other thing we work on in intervention is block takeovers and town hall meetings with local officials so that more community members can be involved in gun violence prevention and what that looks like. There are a lot of residents who don't know how to start or where to start in gun violence prevention, and they may not want to be boots on the ground, but they want to support it. And so our effort is to make sure that the entire community can be a part of gun violence prevention. We've done gun buybacks from the Minneapolis Police Department, where we set up gun buybacks and work with them. People can show up anonymously and turn in their weapons and get a stipend for that payment. And we've also done a number of healing circles and mental health programming in our community. It is important that we take this issue very seriously. We can no longer continue to put band-aids over bleeding gunshot wounds, because as a community and a society, we will not flourish and will continue to have more crimes and more gun victims. I want to thank you, and I want to say that we're supporting this bill because it's important to put a lot of resources and efforts into it. As you see, there's a lot of people on the call today doing this work in many different ways and in many different capacities. And it's not going to take one way or one organization to do this work. It's going to take many, many organizations to have a real change and make sure that this continues, that the work continues. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope that you support the bill, HF 420.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Withers. Thank you for your courageous, visionary, and vital work, the work that you and your brothers and sisters, community members do. I couldn't agree more. It's important to get out in front of this and not just depend on putting band-aids on the harm once it's done. Thank you so much. A lot of courage work. Thank you. With that, our last public testifier is Dakota County Sheriff Tim Leslie. Welcome back to our committee, Sheriff Leslie. Please give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Today I'm representing both the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association and the Minnesota Sheriffs Association in my comments. Generally, we're very positive and want to thank the authors for their efforts. A nice problem to have, right? More money for our communities towards greater public safety, more money for co-responder grants. Yes, please. Both the MSA and the MCPA do have some specific issues with some of the language in the bill. And because of that, we do oppose the bill. I'll detail some of those specific language things. However, as always, we're willing to work with the authors to make sure we get some of those things back to what we agreed with. We agreed that transparency equates to greater levels of trust. We think the bill should require equal levels of transparency and data collection for all grant recipients, not just law enforcement, as this remains the people's money. Does lack some specificity on what like grant capacity trainers means. And then there's some other language like increased funding, rather general. So we'd like to know what those specific pieces mean for us. The money ends in 2025 under Article 1. That's a problem. We gain momentum towards efforts and then the money goes away. As well as there's some some language on $1 million must be $1 million in a grant. We think that's arbitrary. Why is a million some sort of magic number? Maybe it's 900, maybe it's 1.5. The need for additional deputies and officers exists across the state of Minnesota, not just in the metro area. We believe that funding for body-worn cameras is still inadequate. 50% of our agencies, most of which are in greater Minnesota, still don't have body-worn cameras. Some of the body-worn camera language in the bill is already in statute, therefore it's redundant. To take Justin Terrell's testimony further, we believe that body-worn camera policy should be crafted with the community's input, not by statute. The process of community outreach is very important in maintaining and building community trust. And so we don't want to lose that opportunity to work with our communities on what they want to see from our body-worn camera policy. We have no opposition to the next of kin language, but we prefer a 14-day limitation and then making it public at the same time because it just creates less conflict. We are in favor of a blue ribbon panel that does away with a post and creates a post makeover system. 1977 called, they want their post board back. Other than Commissioner Harrington and Sheriff Fletcher, there was no one left from 1977 in this profession, I don't believe. Just think of the technology changes that we've all faced with law enforcement's changes. So we're in favor of blowing that up and starting over. We'll be at the table for that. The bill seeks additional funding to POST for investigations. POST is not an investigative agency. Therefore, we oppose that language. And we did not agree in conversations with the author to restrict the $6 million from the Castillo Fund to only certain mandated trainings like crisis intervention, conflict management, and cultural differences. That was in the 2017 session law. Law enforcement spends over $30 million annually for training. We think that's a great resource for us. And so with that, I will thank you for my opportunity to testify, and I will stand for questions and be in the audience. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Sheriff Leslie. Look forward to continue working with you and your colleagues over at the Chiefs Association. That's all I have for testifiers right now. I'm going to now open this up to committee members. I'll begin with Representative, the author, first of all, Representative Frazier. You've been sitting there for quite a while. You've heard a lot of testimony and no doubt have some thoughts and some advice on some of what you heard. So let's start with you and then we'll move on to your colleagues here on the committee. Representative Frazier.
Yeah, just quickly, Mr. Chair, and I'll stand for questions. Very, very good testimony. Thank you to all the testifiers that were here. But I want to quickly respond to some of the comments that were made by Sheriff Leslie. And just quickly, so the most updated recent bill that I don't think you were referring, I think you're referring to the old bill. The current bill does provide for there are no caps on the grants. So that's one fact I'd like to point out for the record. Also, we provide funding for all law enforcement officers to have access to body cameras. We got that estimate from DPS to ensure that we were providing those resources. Chair, I would like, we have staff here to cover that. So if I could just kick this over to staff to address the issue around the caps and also around the resources for the body-worn cameras.
All right. So you're referring to House staff here?
I think House staff and the House staff for the million-dollar cap or no cap now, and then DPS for the body-worn camera.
Right. Why don't we turn over to DPS on the body cam question? I think the question here has to do with whether or not, correct me if I'm wrong, whether or not these numbers are adequate to make sure that every officer has access in the state to body camera? Is that the?
That's correct.
Okay, all right. Is there anyone here from DPS that can provide
some
information on that? Yes.
Mr. Chair, this is Jordan Holthofterheide, the legislative coordinator for DPS.
Mr. Holthofterheide, good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Frazier. Yes, based on DPS's estimates, the $9 million we do believe will cover the purchase of body-worn cameras for every current licensed peace officer in the state of Minnesota that does not have a body-worn camera. If there is more information, we're certainly happy to work with the author and more stakeholders to get that information. But we believe it does cover that.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Hohaltefein. And thank you for working with the author to shape, you know, those numbers up. All right. Why don't we turn to committee members? We'll begin.
Mr. Chair, there is one more. If you can turn to staff about the cap on the grants.
Okay, Mr. Johnson, I believe.
Mr. Chair, Ben Johnson with House Research. The version of the bill that was posted did have limits related to that $1 million. That language was removed in the Delete Everything amendment. So those $1 million numbers are no longer in the bill.
Very well. It sounds like you've been listening carefully, Representative Frazier, and as you always do, and adjusting your legislation accordingly. All right, why don't we move on to members here? We have about 15 minutes left, and then we'll move to a vote. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I appreciate it. And my questions are gonna be specifically along the lines of the community violence interrupters. And what I'm interested in is finding out how working with violence interrupters is intersecting with our police and how the police are being received in coordination with these violence interrupters. And so my first question, Mr. Chair, is we know that Minneapolis has committed $7.5 million to Minneapolis for the violence interrupter program. And I'd like to hear from any of the testifiers how that program is being received in Minneapolis and if it's effective.
I'd speak 818 shoes.
Mackay, Mr. Lewis, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I can say is knowing some of those individuals that are over there doing that work, I think in a data-driven society, it's hard to put, you know, a number on how many kids are saved by simply seeing two individuals about to blow each other's heads off and you stop them from doing that. I mean, is there a way that you document that down that is acceptable for, you know, committees or for some agency to be able to register it as being sufficient enough? I think that's where one of the problems that we're having when it comes to being able to, you know, put this nail on the boots on the ground organizations is how do we, you know, make sure that these guys are being held accountable for what they say that they're out there trying to do. And, you know, I can tell you that there is ways that, you know, my organization and a few other organizations I know have started to do, and that is track the places that they are at to make sure that, you know, the hours are being kept, to make sure that, you know, there is a way to keep some of these kids' testimonies and some of the issues that they're going through, to make sure that those are documented also with a way for the necessary agencies to be able to contact some of these individuals and if they want to double check to see if, you know, these things are really being done that are saying that the boots on the ground organizations are saying that's being done. I do know from seeing some of the work that it is working. There are countless, you know, times that there is not gun violence and there is not fights that take place because of the work that these, you know, these people are doing. I can vouch for that much.
Mr. Chair. I want to thank Micah for jumping in. I appreciate that, brother, because I know he's not from Minneapolis, and there's no one here from Minneapolis to respond to the questions from Representative Riley. What I would say is that the idea of this program is I have spoken with individuals from or community groups from Minneapolis, and I can say that these programs are being received quite well. That is the reason that Minneapolis put the investment into it that they are doing. These programs are seeing some productive benefits, and so we want to make sure that we can have the resources, permanent resources, to make sure we can continue to have these programs going, but also to expand them as well. That's important for a public safety program overall.
I do note that Mr. McCrary, I believe, does some work in Minneapolis, and I think he said north. Is that correct?
That is correct, Chair. That's my apologies. That is correct.
No, I just wanted to make sure. Mr. McCrary, maybe you can add something quickly here.
Sure. And with that, but, and I will back up kind of what Brother Mackay is saying. It is a bit of a mixed bag, and we have seen good results over here. There has been stuff that has been going down, and we have seen changes and things turn a corner. But identifying and actually be able to track the quantify data, yeah, that is something that we are going to put a finger on. And myself, Justin, and some other folks involved over here are trying to figure out some of the best ways to map that out so those numbers can be looked at and held accountable and also represents what the community wants, first what the community wants, and then reflective of how we are working with law enforcement. It has to be a working relationship with law enforcement. We are going to have to communicate, but not always tell everything at the same time. We're looking forward to being able to do this because we all want the same thing. If we can take some of that stuff off law enforcement's plate at first to go ahead and rectify that so they can focus on the carjacker and not the detox, then, yeah, that's what we're going to do. So it is working, and we do see, you know, some troubles, some bumps in the road, but overall, I think it's a good look.
Mayor, we're going to push on with the questioning. There are some other members here, of course. Ms. Williams does work in Minneapolis. Commissioner Lundy, obviously, in the same geographic area. But Representative Raleigh, I think you might have a second question.
Thank you, Chair. And what I'm worried about is we've gotten reports right now that the city of Minneapolis, with their $7.5 million investment, is currently suing six of the organizations that have been providing the violence interruption services. And I'm wondering, to the author, what processes have you put in place in this bill to make sure that we're not going to repeat these lawsuits and the disruption that's happening with these investments? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Frazier, to your accountability evaluation elements of the bill, no doubt.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is exactly what Justin Terrell was testifying to. This is the importance and the need for the evaluations. Those parameters and those guardrails are in place, and we expect them to be able to do the work accordingly to address any concerns and to hopefully not have any situations. I'm not aware of those situations that Representative Raleigh reported right now, but hopefully not to have situations like that in the future.
And so a new approach, it sounds like, that you're offering, Vice Chair Frazier. All right, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the author. Representative Frazier, I've looked at this bill, read it through, and there are three different spots that I find. Page, it's line 4.5, 15.25, and 18.29, where you've done auto inflators indexing the cost to inflation. It amounts to about $50 million that you have put on autopilot and indexed it to inflation. That's something that we don't really do at the legislature, and I'm wondering if you can give me precedence to, I can't think of anything in the last 10 years where we have put something on autopilot and index it to inflation. Can you give me an example of where we may have done that and where that idea may have come from?
Representative Frazier.
Representative O'Neill, appreciate that. What I can give an example of is that there is, well, right now we're experiencing a rise in inflation. What I'm trying to do is make sure these resources, when we make them permanent, that they stay relevant, that they can always cover the costs that need to be caused to make sure these programs can stay sustainable so they can continue to provide public safety to the communities that we expect them to do and get the results that we expect them to get.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay, so thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Frazier, so you weren't able to give me any examples in current law that we've actually indexed it to inflation, because we typically don't. I can't think of any myself. I mean, I could be wrong, but I have done this a while, been on Ways and Means. I don't recall anything coming through that's indexed to inflation. I'm not sure why this is any more special than something else. This is $50 million indexed to inflation. So I would recommend, if you're going to move this bill forward, that you remove that portion, because it's, yes, we have inflation high right now, but that's why we come back every 2 years and do a new budget and reevaluate everything. So we sort of have that process figured out here at the legislature already. My next question and last question is for Ms. Weeks. And when I was looking at the numbers for OJP's expansion for staff, it's $4.8 million, which could be as many as 48 new FTEs, but you've only articulated in the language 20 FTEs. So I'm not sure if you really meant, I mean, I know how FTEs work, and it's about 100,000 per FTE. That's about what we do for state government.
You've articulated 20. I'm wondering where the other 28 FTEs are, or is this for something else? I'm not quite understanding where the money's going.
Director Weeks.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Neal. That was actually not our language. We are continuing to work with Representative Frazier and staff and formulating what that might look like. In our fiscal note, I'm not sure, it's still being worked on. We were looking at all the different positions that will be needed to support the work envisioned in this bill. The 20 and the 8 that, when we read the language, the 20 and the 8 that you see listed out are for very specific purposes. And then there's other requirements underneath there that will also have staff assigned. And those are not numbers that are enumerated at this time. And so in the work in our fiscal note, we have provided a comprehensive look on how that $4.8 million would be distributed in the staff that is needed to do this work. And that's going to range from not only the outreach, the capacity, the training. It's also going to have grant managers, compliance staff, a statistical analysis center to help with all of the evaluation and report that are due in here, and supervisory staff, because that is a significant investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last comment I would make is, you know, I think that I understand Representative Frazier has been trying to work on this for a while, but there's a lot of unanswered things. There's still some very controversial things in here. And the overall cost is $144.9 million, which would, if you just did FTEs with that amount of money, that's 1,450 new FTEs. Now, I know it's not all FTEs, it's for other things as well, but that's a huge chunk. And I think we need to look a little more closely at what we're doing here. We've been talking about this for quite a while, and it feels like there's still a lot of loose ends and unanswered questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair, if I could just respond, please.
Senator O'Neill, that's what the committee process is all about. I do want to point out that we currently do index our minimum wage requirements in law. So we did that a few years ago. Last year, I actually proposed an indexing of the training dollars, the police training dollars that law enforcement were not objecting to that, making a very, I think, cogent argument to make sure that a dollar today being spent isn't really 50 cents that we're spending. Costs are real, for sure, but fair to debate all these. Representative Frazier.
Thank you for the point about the minimum wage, Chair, before I was able to get there. I understand there's also examples in Health and Human Services, Representative O'Neill, in terms of where we index or forecast to allow those resources to expand. But just to your point about the resources that we're investing in OJP, this goes back to what Representative Riley was talking about. He was talking about the oversight. Those funds that we're putting into OJP is to make sure that we ensure that we give them the resources they need so they have the capacity to do a thorough job with the oversight of these resources. It is a big investment. But it's a big investment because this is a moment that we need to come up with big ideas, and that's what we're trying to do here.
Thank you. All right. Representative Grassley.
We can't hear you, Representative Grassley.
Senator Gross, I believe you might be muted. I am told that we have a little bit of extra time, and so we'll see if we can get through the last two questions here. But Representative,
yes.
Why don't you try that again, Representative Gross?
Working now?
Yes.
I can hear you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. I have a couple questions for the author, probably about three of them. It's looking at the DE2 amendment around the 1019 line starting. The violence interrupters, it talks about them working in conjunction with law enforcement. Do the violence interrupters have a duty to intercede if they have another violence interrupter using excessive force?
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, the bill doesn't specifically address that issue, but I expect in that partnerships that they have with law enforcement, there will be discussions and parameters on how they would deal with those situations.
Representative Grassl?
And that's, I'm sorry to hear that, but Mr. Chair, as far as it should be spelled out in there just for everybody's protection. And I have another couple more that I'll, do these violence interrupters have a duty to respond?
Representative Fraser.
Representative Grassl, a duty to respond to what?
Representative Grassl.
What is the bill for, sir? It is to intercede and to stop violence. And a police officer has a duty to respond when they get the call. They have a duty to respond. Do these violence interrupters, when they get called, do they have a duty to respond?
Representative Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grassl, the whole idea, if these violence interrupters are engaging in the work that they will be doing is to interrupt violence. I think that is explicit in terms of what their titles are. They are violence interrupters, meaning they will be responding to interrupt violence.
Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Fraser. But how are these violence interrupters supposed to know when they are needed? Are they just out roving the streets, or, I mean, how does this work?
Representative Fraser, perhaps one of our...
Quickly, I'll say part of this is going to be in collaboration with law enforcement, so they've worked those details out. But we do have individuals here that work in those areas, so I'd like to kick it over. I think Mr. McCrary might have something to share with that.
All right, let's just take from one, Mr. McCrary. And as you come forward, you know, Representative Grassl, violence interrupters are not going to have permission under the state for use of force. And a number of your questions, it seems to me, arises from that. And so therefore, the requirements in statute and rule for certain behaviors on the part of our licensed public servants who have that permission, licensed permission in our state. This is a whole different collaborative partnering citizen presence here, and their practices are not going to be about using use of force. They do not have state permission and are not licensed to do that. But Mr. McCrary, if you can give us a 30-second sharing, and then we'll push on.
Sure. To answer the questions, to my understanding for some of those groups is that they frequent hotspots around Northside Minneapolis. So there are some spots that see more action than others, and that's where usually they try to make their patrols in and around. Also, relationships with folks in the neighborhood and on the streets kind of see about where that action kind of moves to. Is how my understandings are, is how they've been employed. I'm not directly an inside circle with a lot of these groups, but I do know a lot of the folks inside of there. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, very well. I understand Mr. Franklin, Joel Franklin, as well.
Thank you, Chair. So in St. Paul, our community ambassadors work closely with the St. Paul Police to identify the hotspots. So we are out on the streets engaging young people based on the relationship and the knowledge that we have. We try to intervene before anything really takes off that's violent. We have a strong relationship. We're youth workers. So we basically are trying to intervene with young people before the violence actually happens. And we have a close relationship with the police. If something really violent does happen, we will contact the police and have the police deal with something that's really dealing with a violent activity. But we try to intervene prior to that. And we've been successful in, like I said, talking young people to go home if they have a gun, put a gun down. We've been successful in intervening. But we try to intervene before anything happens. And if you talk to the police officers, they feel our presence when we're not there. Things are more calm. The young people, they feel comfortable coming up to us to let us know if they have an issue with another group, and then we can try to de-escalate and intervene.
Very well. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, one more question, sir?
One more, Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, this conversation, you know, just trying to figure out just what the role is that they play there. I mean, I think it needs to be clarified a little bit better because they say that they work closely with police, work alongside police. But do they respond? Do they go to these? It was just referenced by Mr. Franklin that they will arrive at some of these scenes alone. And I guess my question there is, having the experience in law enforcement of having a scene go from 0 to 100 miles an hour in the wrong direction, just because somebody decides that I don't want to be here anymore, and in my case, a man tried to shoot me in the face. Okay, and this was a displeased customer in a hotel lobby. And all I did was ask him what's going on today. So that's how fast these things can escalate and go sideways really quick, really violent, really bad. And people can die and people can get seriously injured. So I guess my last question, if these violence interrupters are on that scene and one of them should get injured or, you know, heaven forbid, killed while they're trying to work with this stuff, who's liable for that?
Well, in St. Paul with the community, I'm sorry.
I want to keep moving for sure. I do think that there's, I'm okay with the line of questioning here. I do think there's a misunderstanding here. What I'm hearing from many of these community experts and activists is that this is less about acting like police. There are instances when we want police. I've called police. Pretty tense situations, absolutely. This is about getting out in front of the curve. This is about being out in the community. This is about identifying folks that may be wrestling and struggling with things and helping to build the relationships that can lead to much better potential outcomes. So I don't believe Representative Frazier is trying to create a new police department or police force. There's a legitimate function there, but this is not it. Representative Frazier.
Yeah, I'll just quickly to Representative Grosso. Yeah, we're not trying to create a new police force. What we know is there's a dearth of applicants and candidates to hire as law enforcement. So that's not the answer. That's not the way we can answer this. The innovation piece is through the partnerships of working with these violence interrupters, these co-responders, these crime prevention organizations that have been doing this work for years that know what they're doing. The beauty of this is that it goes through every local municipality. They're gonna be presenting these proposals. They're gonna be working with these groups. They're gonna be providing the resources. They're gonna be providing directions on how they work and coordinate and respond accordingly. That's the beauty of this. That's a local thing. They will understand what's best and what works best for their community.
Very well. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, one more quick thing, if I may, please.
Representative Grosso, I've given you a lot of room for one more quick thing.
I'm more than happy to connect with Representative Grosso offline. We can connect. Thank you, Representative Grosso.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grosso. I do appreciate it. I'm going to jump over to Representative Long, and then we'll close out with Lee Johnson, and then we'll move to evolve. Representative Long. And you might be muted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I wasn't expecting you to come right to me, so I wasn't prepared with my mouse. So I appreciate the discussion here, and I just very much appreciate Representative Frazier's work on this bill and the progress that has been made. I'm the sole representative from Minneapolis on the committee. There's been a lot of discussion about Minneapolis today, and my community does need help. We are struggling with an increase in crime. And I think this bill would help in many, many ways. And I think it has a lot of the answers that that my community is asking for in terms of being able to provide resources for our community across a wide range of spectrums. And so I just wanted to speak to a few of those. But first on the violence interrupter, I've been interested that there's been a lot of discussion on the violence interrupter program today. Minneapolis does have a pilot program. It's a pretty new program. I think it's been rolled out for a year or two. There was some really good data from the program last year. In 6 months, violence interrupters successfully mediated over 200 incidents to avoid escalation into possible gun violence. Their focus has been to interrupt gun violence and to interrupt gang violence, but they've gone beyond that. They've had some instances, for example, where they've interrupted things like a child abuse potential circumstance. So, you know, their work has been really valuable. But I think if we look beyond Minneapolis, there are other cities that have had these programs in effect for longer where there has been more data out there. And so if you look, for example, at the cure violence model in New York City, they saw a 63% reduction in shooting victims. If you look at the work in Baltimore, they saw a 56% reduction in homicides. So I do think that we know that these models can be effective in other cities, and I think we want to give them a chance to succeed here as well. We also in Minneapolis are starting to use mental health responders to 911 calls. And I had the opportunity earlier this week, in fact, to meet with Canopy Roots, which is doing some of this work for Minneapolis and is a really impressive organization of mental health professionals who are going out and responding to appropriate 911 calls where they are in need for mental health. And we've seen that is working really well. It's gotten support from the police who I've spoken to who really appreciate having that expertise and mental health response in the appropriate situations. And I think this bill helps in a big way to help with some of those programs and expanding some of those programs. I also just wanted to mention that I appreciate the resources in here as well for making sure that we're doing more investigations and clearing out some of those homicides, robberies, significant cases in Minneapolis and elsewhere. That helps restore trust, that helps ensure that we are being able to work through some of the backlogs in our system. So I just, for many, many reasons, this bill, I think, has resources and program support that we need for effective programs that we know work in communities. And so I thank Representative Frazier for his work on this bill and has my full support.
Very well. Thank you, Chair Long. So then last, we'll have Lee Johnson and members. We have about 5 minutes. I will get to a vote. So if I need to interrupt anyone, please know ahead of time that I will do so. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Frazier. I don't know where to start with this bill.
You have 4 minutes, Lee Johnson.
Well, that doesn't even close enough time that we should be spending on this bill. We spent...
You are also on the Ways and Means Committee.
Approximately 45 minutes listening to people testify and they're saying the same thing over and over again and not allowing my members to actually have time to ask questions, but I'll get on to it.
Lee Johnson, listening to citizens is what we do in the Minnesota legislature. Go ahead, Lee Johnson.
Well, I do have some questions. First of all, this bill is, the total is almost $145 million. Looking at $65 million of it just grants for local communities and local co-responder grants, which looking at the provisions and the requirements, there's about maybe five departments that could get it. And looking at it, I believe one department could get multiple grants and multiple agencies and multiple grants through different organizations inside their community. As Representative Long mentioned, his city is dying because of the huge increase, not a spike, a huge increase in violent crime. Shootings, armed robberies, which are the carjackings, have skyrocketed. I don't know where to begin, and it's all been on 3 years of this committee and your party attacking law enforcement.
Representative Johnson, you're either going to ask a question or you're just going to sit here and take shots at this chair and my party. My suggestion is if that's your purpose and your goal, we can do that on the floor of the House, which is the big theater group. This is committee work. There is a bill before us. It is absolutely correct for Representatives Raleigh, O'Neill, Grassl to ask questions about how this works. It doesn't work. My suggestion is that you follow their suit as well.
Chair Mariani, it's always been custom for the lead to have the last say and issues dealing with this bill, which I'm doing. But I do have a question. One, we talked about the violent preventers. I'm not sure if you're aware, there's 6 lawsuits involving the city of Minneapolis and these violence preventers going on right now because of no data being provided. The city has spent $7.5 million, and we have no idea if it's working or not because we do not have the data. No data has been provided. Nothing's been documented. Representative Frazier, do you have any documentation, I mean actual data, that these programs work?
Representative Frazier and then members, we're going to move to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Long actually spoke to data from around the country where these things work. We also had Commissioner Lundy just sent me a report, so there will be some data for some other cities that are using this type of program or project where we can increase, where we have some data. We had Dr. Sharkey testify in the first week of that we heard this bill about how these things are working and the data that supports it. And Representative Johnson, I will say, we've talked to rural counties and rural cities. They are going to receive a majority of these funds because in the top 20 most violent or violent increased cities, they qualify. A majority of them are outside the metro area. So about 80 municipalities will qualify. So I just want to correct that on the record. Your assertions and mischaracterizations are dead wrong.
Very well. Representative, sure. Reduce the motion that House File 4200.
I make a motion that this bill be laid over.
Representative Johnson, I was in the middle of the motion. Let's see what happens to my motion. Representative Frazier's motion. Representative Frazier, as I was in mid-sentence, renews his motion that House File 4200, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Lee Johnson?
No.
Lee Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
Nay.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
Lucero, no.
Representative Lucero, nay. Representative Mueller?
No.
Representative Mueller, nay. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, no.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Shung?
Aye.
Representative Shung, aye. Chair, that concludes roll call with 11 ayes and 8 nays.
Very well. With a vote of 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails. And House File 4200, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, that concludes our business for today. We'll see you all tomorrow at our regular posted time. Until then, this committee stands adjourned.